Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today we are talking about the movie Steel Magnolias, which is on my rotation to watch today. I've got friends coming over. We're watching that movie. My guest today is Tommy Whitehead, who is a production location consultant and is considered the man responsible for the selection of Natchitoches, Louisiana, for the filming of this really iconic movie. And this is from the Shreveport Times. In the summer of 1989, Hollywood came to Natchitoches for the filming of Steel Magnolias and introduced the historic, quaint small town to the world. There was Dolly, Julia, Olympia, Sally, Shirley, Daryl, as in Parton, Roberts, Dukakis, Field, McLean, and Hannah. They were among the stars playing the characters in the Natchitoches residence. Resident Barbie Harling's book about the death of his beloved sister, who was known as Shelby, in the movie, her name was really Susan, and she passed from complications of diabetes and childbirth. And the movie really is about the family and the town, and Tommy is here to just give us some behind-the-scenes, often hilarious thoughts about this movie. Tommy, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.
Listen, and I remember
I'm glad to be here the day after Thanksgiving. Everybody's happy and ready to go.
Yeah, it's a crazy Black Friday.
Yes. I want to make one note here that the original format was a play in New York. And what is can I start talking now about the story?
Oh, gosh, yes. Listen, I want to tell people I met you at the Natchitoches tour. I go every October, and I met you over there. And you were talking, and I remember just kind of racing over to you and waiting until there was a moment in the conversation that you were having with somebody else and asked you if you would be on my podcast, and you gave me this kind of look like, who is this crazy woman? But thankfully, you said yes, and here we are.
Well, most everything associated with Steel Magnolias sort of goes outside the boundaries of normal life and normal expectations. So I'm used to the different part of dealing with Steel Magnolia stories.
Well, listen, start talking. Before we get going, though, can you tell people a bit about yourself and how you came to be part of this?
Okay. I am a retired professor now, emeritus of the University at Northwestern in Natchitoches, Louisiana. I taught journalism, and I came here in 1969 and been here ever since. The interesting way I got involved in this was Louisiana had a film commission to where they had representatives around the state assisted in location scouting and in making movies. This was a very small office initially. It had like a secretary and a director. And at this moment, whenever Steel Magnolias decided to come scout, there was a political change of governors, and the director of the film commission was out, and there was only a secretary in the office. And I was on the film commission, and Kenita Berthelot, the person there, called me and said, we have somebody that wants to come scout Steel Magnolias. And, of course, that was shot in Natchitoches. Would you come? Would you be willing to show them around? I said, well, sure. I'll be glad to do that. The first thing about the whole thing I thought was interesting was we're in northwest Louisiana, and the scout, he was an associate producer, flew to New Orleans, which is about 300 miles from Natchitoches, because if you come to Louisiana, in your mind, you come to New Orleans. So you meet me in Baton Rouge. So I drove to Baton Rouge, and Andy Stone drove up from New Orleans, and we met and got in the car at the airport when he turned his rent car in. And he said to me, now, I know we're going to Natchitoches, and I know we're going to scout, but I want to look at some other places as well. I just don't want to go to one place. I said, okay. So we went up the Mississippi River Road to St. Francisville, and you cross the ferry then on the river. And we kind of had to go through the pretty part of town to get to the ferry, but we did also see the backside of St. Francisville. Crossed the river, then we went through Marksville, And Marksville is kind of a wonderful downtown, but the rest of it's sort of marginal at that time. And we went through the marginal part of town, and didn't think much of that. Went to Alexandria, and then the interstate was not complete. We went through the back side of town, which is really not a good side of town to go through. And we ended up in Natchitoches. So I really truthfully saved the best to last. And what happened here was interesting. The big determining factor in shooting the film here was going to be a soundstage. And they knew we didn't have anything, you know, big, real soundstage. But we could, was there anything they could improvise into a soundstage? Now, whether I was wise or not, I decided that perhaps what I should do is you don't show the best thing first. You show the worst things first and then the best at the end. So we had three possible spaces at the University of Northwestern State in Natchitoches, and I had keys to all three. It was a Wednesday night, and it was truly a dark and stormy night. We go to the first venue, which was we called it the old men's gym, not because the men were old, because it was a new men's gym as opposed to the old men's gym. We went there, and it was old. It had been basically abandoned. There were some intramurals going on in there, but not any regular activity. And I had the key, and they had the light. We knew where the light switch was. And I turned the light on, and birds were roosting up in the attic, the steel framework, and they all flew like in the Birds movie. And so Andy said, "Oh, this won't do at all. We can't do this." So we go out and we go to number two on my list, which is where they play basketball now. It's a caverner's place. Huge, and it has these funny mercury vapor lights that have a grayish blue tint to it at that time. So we go in there, turn on the light, and as you just said here, I said something, and my voice just carried through the cavernous space, huge space. And Andy looked at me and said, "Oh, this won't do at all. The sound is terrible." So I had saved the third for last. And we went to a building where they do health and physical education instruction, the PE majors, we call it. And we walked in there. I had the key, turned the light on, and basically what it was a double gym, two gyms built together. And it was built with some federal money, and they did not allow bleachers or venues to play where people could do competitive athletics and watch. So there was nothing in the room but two gyms, two open spaces where they could practice and teach basketball. We did all of that. And I looked in, and Andy said, "My gosh, this is better than some studio at Warner Brothers or somewhere," which was supposedly the best studio in L.A. size-wise. So this was really tweaked his interest. And that was how we started off our trip to Natchitoches on a stormy Wednesday night in March of 1989. March 1988, we did the Scout.
And here's the thing about Natchitoches, if you haven't been there, and I know many of our audience haven't and may not have the opportunity, it's a beautiful town. It really is. I've been all over it. I don't find any bad spots in it. It's just a lovely, lovely town.
It is the oldest city in the states of the Louisiana Purchase. It's older than New Orleans. It's 1714, and it was here because you could navigate the Mississippi to the Red River, and it was the closest distance from here to the Spanish territory of Texas. So at one time, a press account wrote that they thought Natchitoches might become the biggest city in the United States because it was going to be the gateway for international trade. That didn't happen. That's another story for another day. Well, the next morning, the other factor determined after the space for a studio, possibly, was to find a house. And the house had special specifications. They wanted to have a front, but they also wanted a back view of it where you could have a swimming. They wanted a swimming pool at the yard. So I only knew of two people in town that had backyards with swimming pools. And so I went to the first one. I didn't know what he wanted until he got to town. So I couldn't call ahead, so we didn't have mobile phones then. So I drove to this house in town, and I said, "This is what you're describing. It has a front, beautiful front yard, historic old house, and the backyard you can drive in, and there's a swimming pool back there." And we drove up there about 7:30 in the morning, and I didn't even know to call the people, so I just rang the doorbell, and the owner's wife came to the house door in her bathrobe and kind of groggy. She knew me, And she said, what can I do for you? I said, well, I have a movie scout from Los Angeles. We want to look at the possible house as a location for Steel Magnolias. Well, she almost dropped it right then. And her husband was in the bed asleep still. So she got him out of the bed. And that was the first contact with the family where we eventually shot the whole movie in their yard. And I found it at 7:30 in the morning. They had another house. They had needed another house as well. And I knew another house with a swimming pool, the Gahagans. And we went over there. And, again, they were just stirring around, getting up and getting dressed. And they were very receptive, very nice folks. And they gave us the tour that we wanted. So by 9 o'clock, we had a location possible for the house they needed and also a location for the soundstage. And that was sort of the beginning of the Steel Magnolia experience here in Natchitoches.
That, and I think a lot of people don't really realize either that the story is a true story. And the person who wrote it is from Natchitoches. And, you know, I remember her parents, or his parents, too, you know, the Julia Roberts,
the Harlings.
Susan, the Harlings, mm-hmm. Exactly. And they were docents for many, many years. I think she passed away, what, 5 years ago or something.
And Mr. Harling died last year.
Recently, mm-hmm. Yeah. And sweet, sweet people. But I've got to tell you, Tommy, I've watched that movie a lot. And it took, you know, you don't know these things about movies when you're first watching them. But at some point I realized it was a true story. And it was based in Natchitoches, one of my favorite towns. So that made me very happy. But I've met Mrs. Harley many, many times, and I've got to tell you, I cannot reconcile the lady that I knew, and well, I didn't know her well, I've met her many times, and Maylin, how do you pronounce her, Maylin? She was kind of nasty.
Maylin.
Nellie Field character, she was mean. And I'm thinking, how in the world could she, maybe she was just strong-willed? What am I missing?
Well, Mrs. Harling was definitely strong-willed, and she has sort of more or less become the model for the Steel Magnolia, too. Mrs., what you have to do, and I was told in a performance piece, like a play or a movie, that you have to have some exaggeration of character to make it more dramatic on the stage and more real, you know, that in terms of movie real, than if you're just a nice, mild-mannered, meek person to get what you want in your own way without having to be nasty.
Yeah, because I never could reconcile the lady that I'd met with that character, and I knew there had to be a backstory.
There was. And another factor that to make a comment about here is that the span of the time frame from when the play was opened in New York and the movie was made was unbelievably short. Usually a play will run and go through some different versions and, you know, then they'll decide to make a movie. This was all done within a year. The play in New York was a hit. It was an off-Broadway production. And Ray Stark, the producer from Los Angeles, one of his assistants had seen it in New York and said, Ray, you've got to come to New York and see this. So he went to New York and saw the play and then immediately wanted to get the rights to the movie and purchase the film rights to it. So the play was still a big runner, a big success on Broadway, off-Broadway, whenever the movie was made. And when the actresses read the characters, the play, each one was such a dramatic person that they all wanted to play it. It was a juicy role. You know, Shirley MacLaine being Weezer was just nasty, and she just loved that part of the performance. So there's just
I loved her in that. I thought
she was terrific. It was great in the play. And, of course, I think it made Julia Roberts a star, her role there. She was unknown. She had only done, I think, Mystic Pizza, some unknown film, and did this one and became a star. And, of course, anytime you put Dolly Parton in a movie, you got it right there. So the characters, and Sally Field had just won that past spring an Oscar for one of her roles. So you brought together a group of enormously talented women in a small venue. This play has only got, you know, very small. The play was only six characters. But now the movie, you had opened it up some, but still these characters that were on the play are in the one in the movie. So it was a dramatic, it happened so quickly, it astonished everybody.
And Tommy, I remember either you or, you know, one of the other, like I was all over that town, and everybody there had been part of the movie in one way or another, and I was soaking it up, so I don't remember who was telling what, but I do remember somebody saying that the play was a woman-only play. that Tom Skerritt role and the others had to be added to the movie itself. Is that correct? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, the play's only got female characters in it. And that's one reason why the play is still being performed today all over the world, because it has all female characters. It has one set, the beauty shop. It's easy to produce on stage. There's no sets to move. And it's great, juicy roles for each of the actresses. So it's definitely a feminist play in that the actresses can develop themselves into these roles. It's being done in Minneapolis now at the Guthrie Theater. It's being performed and got rave reviews at this time. This is 30 years later. So it's amazing how the life of this story continues, the lifespan of it.
It's a lovely story, and if you don't mind, I do want to get back to the production because it's fascinating. But
okay.
Let's talk about Bobby Harling a bit, because he is local.
Okay.
He was his sister. It's his family. He still lives there.
Mm-hmm.
Can you chat about him just a little bit?
Well, he is a person that, you know, he graduated from here at Northwestern in Natchitoches University. He actually finished on a program where you go 3 years, and if you go to law school and graduate from law school, then you get your degree from Northwestern as well. He did that with Tulane Law. And this is the first thing he ever wrote was this Steel Magnolias. Isn't that amazing? The very first script you write becomes a worldwide hit 30 years later. He wrote it. And he took it to New York, and people read it and wanted to produce it, which is another rarity of first work to get produced, and it was done so quickly. Everything about Steel Magnolias had a touch to it that was special like that. And Harling has come back home, and he has a beautiful plantation here in Natchitoches, and you see him in town at the grocery store and various places. He's not at all reclusive or anything, and a very nice person. So, you know, it's just a real story in a real place. And that's what Harling, and he continues that. You'll see him around town and doing things in various places, but he's a normal person. I mean, he's one of us.
Exactly. And I think that for me and, you know, people that I know who have watched this movie, it's the true story component. It is a true story, and it didn't get too off-center in the movie as far as I can tell, but it's a lovely story. And Truvies, you know, she was the last stop, you know, that house, and that was the last stop on the tour. That was fascinating, I have to say. Okay, so keep on going, Tom, because I don't want to interrupt you too much.
The beauty shop was a couple blocks from their house. Miss Harling could even walk over there if she wanted to. And they rent there, and these characters that are in the film, now, of course, in it to make a script, you have to exaggerate some, but still, those are real people. Liz Landrum's beauty shop was where it was, and this is kind of a neat story. When they were doing the beauty shop on the soundstage to do the scenes inside, they were looking for all the props, the table, the wash bins, and all the combs and brushes, and they finally just went to Liz Landrum and says, "Sell us everything you have. We will replace every brush, every tray, every wash bowl, everything you have. Just let us take it all from you, and we'll buy you all new." And they did that. So the props in the movie are the real thing from the real beauty shop in Natchitoches.
I didn't know that. These are the kind of stories I love. Oh, and you know what else I wanted to get into? When we were under that big tent, we were all talking. You were talking. I was just listening.
Yes.
I probably looked vacant because I was so fascinated. But you were also the ladies who created the armadillo cake. And I've got some great pictures
yes.
of you with them if you want me to email them to you, by the way.
Well, let me tell you, you can. Let me tell you the armadillo cake story.
Yeah.
The script has in it the armadillo cake. Well, when they came here, that was one of the jobs that I did as production location was consultant, was to do things that nobody else did. There was no one else in the operation that was scheduled to be looking for armadillo cake. Well, that was something he made up. Well, but I finally got a list of names of some ladies around town that made cakes, just birthday cakes and wedding cakes. So I called Miss Mayu, and she lived out in the country, and I went out to her house and said, "We need an armadillo cake." And she said, "Well, I don't know, make Mark Demichelis cake." I said, "Well, let me get some pictures of armadillos," and took him to her, and she started making an armadillo cake. And, you know, it was a work in progress. She would bring a new cake up to the production office nearly every day, and we ran into a big problem early on. The frosting that you use to make gray color on fruit, for cake frosting, that frosting, it would turn green if it got hot outside in the sun. So for a week or two, every morning, we would get a cake from the baker, and we would go outside the building, set it on a table where the bugs and stuff couldn't get to it, and it would sit all day to see what happened to it. I think she told me it was the 14th try before they made a cake that would stay gray all day long. She has hilarious stories. That's what we were talking about that morning, is making the armadillo cake. She now has a unique specialty of armadillo cakes.
And I think when the lady that was with her, I didn't catch her name, said that this was before fondant, so this, you know, you had to make real icing. But what got me was when they were talking about how she found that dead armadillo on the road.
Yes,
and had
yes.
her husband take it. I just gagged. I almost threw up on her feet. It was just,
yes.
Oh my God.
They commandeered a dead armadillo to make. She didn't know exactly what an armadillo looked like, you know, the texture, the roundness of where the round parts were. So rather than look in books, they found a dead armadillo, and that became the model for the cake.
Exactly.
It's a terrible story.
And anybody who has come across a dead animal in Louisiana on a summer knows what that smells like. You can't get it out of your car
yes.
for a while. It's horrible. Okay, Tom, keep going, because I mean, this is fascinating, and I don't
want
to interrupt.
The armadillo cake was another one of the armadillo cake was one of another one of the sagas for the whole production, was getting armadillo cake that would last all day. The people in town responded amazingly. They had some casting calls for extras. And, I mean, they needed, like at the Easter egg hunt, which is the closing scene of the movie, they needed little kids, 4, 5, 6-year-old kids, that would be, you know, dressed in Easter finery, hunting eggs on the riverbank downtown, in downtown Natchitoches. Well, we put out notices whenever we were having public press releases, and we had one afternoon, we have an auditorium at the campus that would seat about 1,300 people. They more than that showed up. We had to have two sessions of the casting call for the kids to be in the egg hunt. There were so many parents brought junior and daughter over here to be tried out for the Easter egg hunt on the riverbank. So every time we had a casting call, there would be enormous response. Some places they have trouble getting people, but not here. The kids were every doting mother, you know, Hollywood mother type person was there with their kitty in tow. And then the same thing, this is another sidebar of the story that's funny. The movie has a scene in it where Shirley and Olympia is in the dressing room. Olympia owns the radio station, and she's doing a remote broadcast whenever their football team has won, the football team scene. Well, the script originally talked about a football game, but they decided to make it more reasonable to do it in the locker room. So they needed a bunch of college guys to be the football players in the movie. Well, under NCAA rules then, I guess still today, they cannot use real athletes in movies because it's an issue about publicity and stuff. So we had a casting call for young men, and we eventually got two fraternities to provide members of their chapters to be the football players. This is the fun part. They had three pay scales. If you had on your uniform in the locker room, like you just came off the field, you got, I don't know, I'm making up this number, like $75. If you had just a towel wrapped around you, you got $100. But if there are some in there that are full nude, you know, you don't see anything, but you see the backside or their side of the body or something, they got paid $125. So there was, and then that was quite, it was went on all day long. So they needed somebody to make the football players look like they were wet with sweat from coming off the field at a game. So what they had to do after this was not working too well without that, they got the ladies that worked in the production office to come over there, and they got water bottles like you spray a window cleaner, and every time there was a break, these ladies all generously volunteered to go spray the boys, who were nude especially, in the locker room scene. So that went on all day. I only went there briefly because I left. Yeah, you got to do what you have to do.
That's exactly. I would have helped. I really would. You know, out of the kindness
of my heart. Yes. there were actually people pushing each other who could spray whom. Anyway, that's another story.
And wasn't there a – I know you're talking about the sound stage earlier, but wasn't there I wish I'd written this down during that day, but it was just – that was honestly the best tour I've been to, and I've been going for years. Wasn't there a thing where about the air conditioning in that sound stage where they had to overnight
yes,
an air conditioner
or that was a – yes, that was a crazy story. When the very first day of shooting, they did prep for a week or two. They actually constructed the beauty shop, the whole house inside the soundstage, and it had flyaway walls. The walls would come apart to where you could take a wall out and shoot people talking and stuff as if the camera was in the room. They just took the walls off. And the very first day of shooting, it was like a call at 6 o'clock in the morning. They got over there, and the place was hot. And they all just went nuts because the air conditioner wasn't putting out cold air. We got in engineers quickly, and they determined the fact that they needed wasn't enough air conditioning power in there. So they decided the movie company would pay to have an additional air conditioner compressor put in the gymnasium space, little gyms, and that would make sure there was enough cold air. So they went and put it in. And they also, unlike the previous night, left the regular air conditioning on all night. It had been on an automatic thermostat timer, and it didn't kick on to 5 in the morning. And unbeknownst to them, if they had left it on all night, it would have been cold in there the next morning. So they did, but they wanted to make sure that it never had a problem with heat before. So they installed this new central air conditioning compressor on the roof. And we had to get the city at the same time to run a power cable from the highway, a bypass about a mile away, and poles. All this was done in a day. Everybody was just going nuts about the air conditioning. And when the film ended in September, I was the last person here wrapping up business and stuff. I had a call from Los Angeles saying that they'd never paid for the utility use. They paid for the pole and the wires that were put in, but they never got a bill for usage. So I went down to City Hall to get the bill. They wanted to pay the bill for the power they used on the new air conditioning unit. I go down to City Hall. They scrabble around and look, and the bill was $1. Come to find out, they never, ever turned it on. They just left the regular air conditioning on overnight every night, and it provided all the cold air they needed. So the movie company gladly, the city, I went to pay the $1, and the city didn't take my $1. They said, forget about it. So we spent a whole bunch of money on air conditioning compressors on the roof of the building, running wire and poles, and nobody ever used it.
That's crazy. But look, Southwest Louisiana, it's humid. And in the summer, honestly, if you're not used to it, I can see why they would have a problem. But I've been here for a long, 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 long time. First, you know, when summer comes back after a little bit of autumn and we've, you know, low humidity, that first couple of days of summer, you don't want me in a car. I'll probably try to kill you. It's bad.
It's horrible. And they were used to the air conditioning in Los Angeles. You know, it's weather was basically year-round similar. It's not any hot.
Right.
Like it was probably 89 degrees or so, and humidity was high the first day of production. But, you know, you learn, and oftentimes one learns, that the crisis of the moment will be forgotten by tomorrow. If you can get through today, you're all right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
exactly.
You know, it takes I figured that out real quickly. And you know, the thing that I don't think a lot of those people understood was just be patient and not get excited, and you get more things done. And I learned that summer better than I had ever learned in my life, and I have still used that learning today, that knowledge. When something's a crisis, if you just pause a few minutes or an hour or two, sometimes that crisis will go away.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you wholeheartedly. So when I remember you talking about how the movie, it wasn't scheduled until I think later in the year or even a following year, but all of a sudden all of the actresses came available at the same time. And I think that's one of those touch points that you're talking about, one of those things that just kind of miraculously happened with this movie.
Yes, and they also, being in a small town here, the actresses bonded. You know, they would visit with you. In Los Angeles, you go home and you do your life. Here, they all had some connections. I can remember seeing Shirley MacLaine at the, back then we had video rental stores, remember those, Blockbuster, and you'd see her in there renting movies and stuff. They actually mingled in the community with the people here as well as amongst themselves. They were here the 4th of July. They were starting filming that next day or 2 days later or something. And the movie company came to me and said, we need to put together a 4th of July event for the ladies. Well, the house, I live on a lake, and Shirley MacLaine's house was also on this lake. So I went to a local restaurant here, and they fixed all that. Of course, they all want health food. They want healthy things. But I also learned if you'll put something fat and greasy in front of them, they'll generally eat that too. But we all went. I got all this wonderful food, and it was only like 10 people there. And I always say that there was a mermaid there because Daryl Hannah just finished doing the mermaid movie. And also there was a princess, Lee Radziwill, Jackie Kennedy's sister, was dating Herbert Ross, the director. They got married later, and Lee was there. So we had a princess, we had a mermaid at the 4th of July party with 20 guests.
I had forgotten about the princess being there, and I remember there was quite a bit of talk about her being there. And she, you know, she was in her own way kind of royalty. One of the stories that y'all told was Dolly Parton, who I have to tell you is one of my all-time favorite artists. Singing, whatever she, I think she's just such a lovely person. And tell the story about how somebody was trying to peek at her through the windows, and she had to move.
Oh yes, they had to rent. Each actress played arrangements for the people. We had a realtor hired here on the payroll to find an appropriate house to rent for the major stars in the movie for the shoot. And there was a pecking order. The higher you were in the movie script deal, the top, the names on the order on the script, in the credits, that was who got the best house and the next house, et cetera. Like then, Julia Roberts had a small house because she was the lowest on the totem pole. And but Dolly had probably as big a house as Shirley MacLaine, and it was on the river, Cane River, which is actually Cane River Lake. It's not a flowing river. It's a dammed up oxbow lake. Well, the first morning, Dolly got there in the night and spent the night, and then got up the next morning and opened the windows, going and looking over at the water, at the river behind her house, the Cane River. And there were people sitting out there in boats with binoculars trying to see in the house. So we swapped houses around. Ray Stark had a house on a golf course, which you couldn't get to the back of it, the backside of it. So Dolly moved into Ray Stark, who was the producer of the film, his house, and instead Ray moved over to the house that Dolly had. And then Ray Stark had been out here to my house, because I have a house on another lake, and it's a kind of a small, comfy house. And Ray said to me, why don't you swap houses with me? I'd rather be on your lake than this road. I said, no, I'm not swapping houses. I wasn't going to move out of my house into another house in Natchitoches for him to live here. He traveled a lot anyway. So it was just, we had a week or two of house moving that was sort of crazy at times.
And, you know, Natchitoches is full of, I don't know that there are any Bellum homes, but, you know, vintage homes anyway outside of the, you know, the antique homes
yes,
that are part of the tours. I mean, it's really a beautiful place. So when you say you would see these actresses, and I'm guessing Tom Skerritt, I think, was known for running around on a bicycle,
yes,
which is easy to do. It's a small town. So are there any, I know one of the stories you told Tommy about taking Shirley MacLaine to one of the plantations and her eating crawfish, yes, crawfish etouffee.
Well, I took Lee Radziwill, Jackie Kennedy's sister, was here, and she wasn't involved in the movie. Her boyfriend, Herbert, was directing. And Lee got wind that one of the plantation houses out here on Cane River, there's some historic homes outside of town along what used to be the Red River, that she had heard of that Cherokee plantation was very nice. So the owner of it lived in El Dorado, Arkansas, Theodosia Murphy Nolan. And I called Theodosia, and we set up a day or two later, and Theodosia came down from Arkansas, and I took Lee out there, and she had with her a friend, and we got out there, and Lee was a little bit happy, kind of, you know, a little bit on the socially conscious side, and she had with her of a woman from Newport as well as New Orleans, Mimi Coleman. And Theodosia Lee went off on these discussions about how wonderful, yada, yada, yada. Well, finally, Theodosia came in, and we go down there, and I go take the two ladies out there, and we go to the house, and we open the door, walk in. Lee walks in first and introduces, and then she, Theodosia, I love that name, Theodosia sees Mimi and says, Mimi, and Mimi says, Theodosia. They were old friends, and Lee could not believe that anyone in Natchitoches knew Mimi Coleman of the Newport Colemans. So it was one of the moments, but I have a better story about Cherokee Plantation. Once the word got out how special Cherokee was, Shirley MacLaine wanted to go out there. So I took Shirley out there one afternoon after work, or she wasn't working that day. And I had called Theodosia. She came back down from El Dorado, and we go out there, and it's a lovely visit. We sit on the front veranda, the front porch, and have mint juleps, you know, and all that. And then we sat and talked so long. Finally, Theodosia said, Shirley, would you like to stay for dinner? We're going to have some crawfish etouffee. Well, Shirley said, well, yes, I'd love to. Well, in the process of all this getting ready and having the cook pull the food out of the refrigerator and fix it, warm it and everything, Theodosia got to telling a story that there was a history of a ghost at Cherokee Plantation, and that went off on all these stories about the plantation. Well, Shirley said, supposedly the ghost is in the attic. And Shirley said, Theodosia said, well, Shirley, would you like to go up in the attic? And she said, sure, I'd love to. I want to feel the ghost, Uncle Charlie. So I go in there, and I get Shirley in the steep steps. We go up in the attic, and one of the moments of my life, or the last time I close my eyes, will be when Shirley MacLaine has got her hands behind her back walking around the attic feeling for ghosts. I thought this was an ultimate moment to be in an attic with her feeling for spirits. And it really she said she felt something, but she couldn't be sure who it was. So, or something like that. But it was a moment of my life to see in the attic with Shirley feeling for spirits.
I can imagine. And if you've read her books and know what she's all about, that's totally understandable.
Yes.
So she's a fascinating person. In fact, I watched over the week, I want to say the weekend, it's not because it was Wednesday. It feels like a weekend because this is a long weekend. But, you know, I thought, okay, I'm watching Steel Magnolias again this weekend, this coming weekend. So let me go watch Guarding Tess, which is another one of my favorite of her movies. So I'm ready for Shirley MacLaine this weekend. That's all I've got to say.
Well, she was delightful here, and so were Olympia Dukakis. Olympia had just won the Oscar Academy Award when she was here, and her first cousin was running for president when Michael Dukakis was running for president. So there was even
right.
a little political rally on campus with the Democratic kids to get together with Olympia and cheer on Michael Dukakis.
And was it her? Was it any of the? I know there was some kind of problem that the actresses or, you know, many of them could not pronounce the town name Natchitoches. So is that where Chicopin Parish came from? First time I heard that, I went, there's no such thing as Chicopin Parish in Louisiana. I mean, I knew that much.
Well, I think he wanted to kind of protect the city's name when he was writing it. But the reason why Chicopin does have a meaning, whenever the earliest settlers came here, the people that lived here were an Indian tribe. There was an Indian village settlement here, Native Americans, and they were called, they were the Chinkapin tribe, and they called it Natchitoches or something, a name like that. And that's where the name Natchitoches have roots in that tribe of Chinkapin Indians. And they still use the word Chinkapin around here for street names and stuff.
Restaurants, yeah, I've noticed that.
There's a lot of Harling wrote the thing to be, you know, to be local, of course. It's very Christmas festivals in the movie. That's a big social event here every spring, every winter. But he also put enough clues in it that you knew it was Natchitoches.
Right. Well, so what are some of your other lingering stories about this movie? I mean, when I was wandering around town, and like I say, I've been there year after year after year, this one was truly the best. It was so special. And we had the opportunity to meet so many people who had been part of the movie or involved in the movie. And I remember one gentleman, I think he started speaking after you were done, and I didn't catch his name, very tall, but I think he was basically shadowing Dylan McDermott to kind of ease his accent, because he didn't say
I don't know who that. I left. My program at the museum that afternoon was with Bobby Harling, the playwright. That's the first time he had done That's the first time he ever did a talk here in Natchitoches about the movie. And we had a full house. We had 200 people, something like that, attended. And it was packed in. Nobody else could get in. But Bobby related stories about Natchitoches and the filming and, you know, all of this and writing the story. So it was a very special day. And I think a lot of people here who after 30 years, we're sort of Steel Magnolia worn out. But it revived all of our interest in Steel Magnolias this past that weekend. And what you're talking about being here that weekend as a guest, it was amazing that there were so many people from out of town. Oklahoma, Texas, all around the country came. One person in town here, Danny Dice and his wife, they hosted that night. They had recreated the wedding reception, which was not at the house where the movie was filmed originally. The wedding reception was somewhere else. But they recreated the wedding reception in their backyard, and they had 360-something guests buy tickets for that event. So it's amazing on a Saturday night in Natchitoches in November that they sold 363 tickets to attend a wedding reception that happened 30 years before. And they had armadillo cake, they had all of that, and all that stuff was there.
Yeah, they were setting that up just as we were wandering out. So do you mind sharing some of the reminiscences that Bobby Harling had to say during that event?
Well, he mostly told stories about his family, his sister dying, and, you know, it's a real, very real story. And the original intent of the plot story he goes with is that she had a baby. The baby was really small. She had the baby, and her death was a result of some after effects of the birth. But that he wanted that baby to know about his mother, and he thought that writing this play would be kind of a catharsis to tell the story of his mother that would be documented, you know, the community she lived in, what it was like to live here. And that was a basis of starting Steel Magnolias. He thought about a book, he thought about other formats, but he decided the characters were such that they would fit a play better than a book.
And that makes sense. I mean, these characters, all of them are just so much larger than life. I mean, they really are. One of the things I wanted to ask you, too, was about the Evian.
Oh, we went on one afternoon. I was at my desk in my office. I just sat there waiting for things to come to me many days. It was always something going on. The people in the makeup department came to me, or the head of the makeup department, wanting to know they needed Evian. Because when the ladies got hot during the day on the set, and they wanted you can get Evian in a mist bottle, or you can mist it. And they wanted to mist it. They wanted to be able to mist the ladies during the day without messing up their makeup. When it was hot, they needed to cool off. Well, you know, Walmart did not have Evian here. So I didn't know I had to think about this a minute, and I thought, and I called Neiman Marcus in Dallas. They had what they wanted, the Evian in a bottle with a sprayer, and we had it FedExed. The FedEx was an essential part of the component of shooting the movie. Every day, they had to put, actually, the FedEx deliveries come from Shreveport Airport, and they actually put a bigger truck on this route because there were so many stuff coming down here every day for the movie. And remember, this was for the internet, so you had to send things back and forth by documents and stuff. You FedEx papers and stuff back and forth. So FedEx was a central component of making the movie happen here because of the their ability to deliver stuff from Los Angeles or Dallas or wherever every day.
Now, when you were telling that story, I went, they couldn't just use regular water, but apparently not.
Oh.
But I remember
you
were everybody's favorite person because you had the credit card.
I had the credit card, yes. I could buy things. And my expense account was charged to post-production marketing. So I could spend things that did not appear in the budget of the movie.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, let's.
But I'm not sure what Evian would have made much difference in the cost of a movie, but I could buy things that were not charged to the movie.
That's crazy. Okay, how long did this movie take? Because I remember you saying that all of a sudden they had, you know, all these actresses were just miraculously available. And didn't you say it took a very short time to get this movie up, running, and wrapped up?
The original intent when they started this scouting business was just in the spring, that they would shoot it the next year because Dolly Parton had it. They were trying to get all the next window that when all the actresses would be available would be the next year. Well, all of a sudden, whatever project Dolly had going on didn't go through, or they changed it or something. So all of a sudden, all six women were available starting in May or late May, early June. So they had they only came here the first time in March, so they only had a month of prep, month and a half of prep. So they managed to all of a sudden go into overdrive to get the thing ready to shoot by July 1st or July 3rd or whatever day they started in July. So there were rehearsals for the month of June, more or less the month. And the sets were built. It was 2 month prep for this film, which was an extraordinarily short period of time. It was basically May and June, and they started shooting in July. It was
very quick, and they
were out of here by. They left town in September, about the second week of September. The last hurrah was Dolly Parton agreed to sing the song or two at the football game at halftime. So the halftime show at the first football game was Dolly Parton singing.
That's amazing. One of the things, Tommy, and I didn't hear you say this. I heard somebody else say it. Somebody from the university, and he was saying. That when you're watching the movie, of course, there's a lot of locals there, and after I met some of these, I'm hoping to see them in the movie. But is this correct, or is my memory correct on this, that the doctors and the nurses that you see in the hospital scene were the actual doctors and nurses who treated Susan?
Yes, the doctors, they were in Shreveport, and they came down to Natchitoches and worked a day or two as extras in the scene where she dies. Yes.
No.
They had the real doctors. And she was a nurse, so they knew her personally as well as professionally.
Right. And I think he said that the nurse who actually had to, I hate this term, but pull the plug was the right nurse. Yeah. Was the nurse who
I understand
actually
that. I can't verify that, but I've heard that. So I don't know which part. Whenever they had scenes like that, I stayed away from the set. I very seldom ever went to the set. I thought my life was a lot easier when I was in my office behind my desk dealing with things.
That makes sense. So what else in that time really kind of sticks with you? You know, there had to have been some things that people don't even know about because, you know, they see the movie, oh, it's a great movie, thank you, but they don't understand all the things, you know, big things, little things, hysterical things that are going on behind the scenes. So what are some of your biggest and most enduring memories outside of Shirley MacLaine looking for ghosts? I love that story.
Well, there's so many stories, and a lot of my stories have nothing to do with the actual production of the movie. It had to do with the people. One thing just came to mind while we were talking here was during dailies, when they showed dailies every afternoon, back then it was from the previous day, they sent the film to L.A. and it was processed and flown back. We had a courier that met jet planes in Shreveport and stuff. Herbert decided to have snacks. He wanted to have refreshments during dailies. So one day Herbert decided he wanted to have sushi. Well, there is a renowned sushi restaurant somewhere in Los Angeles. Well, they made this huge, it was a big deal getting it set up. The sushi place took the fresh sushi to LAX to put on the plane for the bag for Delta to bring to Shreveport to come bring here for dailies. We're going to have fresh sushi cut that morning in Los Angeles and sent here for the afternoon. They had it all planned. They mishandled the sushi. So someplace, some airport, there may be sushi rotting still today. We don't know what happened to the sushi. But the sushi got mishandled and didn't get to Natchitoches. So there's sushi somewhere, unclaimed sushi.
So did they not, you know, kind of look into the local cuisine? Because we've got some fabulous food in this state.
They do, but they were very, at times, very health conscious, organic and all of this. But then you'd put a plate of something fried, meat pies in front of them or something, they'd eat it. Most of them would. So
well, yeah.
it was a convenient health thing.
Gotcha. So what else do you, I mean, I know you said they rented houses. We talked about that. They shopped at Brookshire's, which now is Super One, I believe. It's a grocery store. And
it
they
is.
Ate at the Marinette restaurant. And Cherokee, when you mentioned Cherokee, is that still in private hands? It seems to me like that's part of the state park system now. Or am I thinking
no,
of another?
No, Cherokee is privately owned by a foundation
okay.
in El Dorado, Arkansas, the Cherokee Plantation Foundation.
What am I thinking
it's open.
Of?
They open it for various events, but it's not open. It's not open every day.
Gotcha. I'm thinking of another one that I think it was belonged to the Prudhams at one time. What am I thinking of?
There's Oakland. Oak is a national
Oakland,
park.
That's the next
That's the next plantation down from Cherokee is Oakland.
Right.
And it's
right.
It's well done interpretation. It's done very well.
Exactly. So. Don't let me interrupt you. You keep on going because this is fascinating.
And as you and I tell these stories, it comes back to my mind. Sometimes some of these things seem to be repressed. All of a sudden, I think about something. I will say this. The people that made the movie in the marketing department, Ray Stark and Don Safran, they were the people in the corporate office. They were extraordinarily nice to me. I got tickets to the New York premiere of Steel Magnolias, and I went there, and it was wonderful. It was a big theater right off of Rockefeller Center, and a great dinner party afterwards. And then the ultimate, I guess, the thing they did for me was they got me tickets for the Academy Awards. I got to go to Oscar.
Nice. That's very nice. So when you were doing all of this, you just kind of, and I want to talk a bit about how you landed in this, because it seems to me from reading a little bit and meeting you in Natchitoches, you just kind of got landed in it and then just took off running. How did that happen?
I was not the marketing director was on the first scout here. Once the man came, he came. Don Safran came on the next thing, and he understood that I was educated. I mean, I had degrees and stuff, and that I understood what was getting to happen here. I understood movie making enough to know. He told me, just sit back and watch this, because they don't make movies like this anymore. This was, you know, Ray Stark was kind of wild and crazy, but I mean, there's so many stories that Ray Stark doesn't get to drive in Los Angeles. He has a driver. Well, here they gave him, he wanted the smallest car. He didn't want anybody to have a car smaller than him. He wanted to be he owned the studio and everything, and he wanted to have the smallest car. And he'd get lost everywhere he went. So if he wanted to go somewhere, we had to have a teamster drive a car and Ray follow him to get there, but Ray wanted to drive his own car. So it was just things like that. And I relished what was happening. I understood this was special now. And I just sat back and watched the whole thing and took notes and my mental notes of it, of what was happening.
Are you ever going to write a book about this?
No. No. There's, you know, some of that stuff is kind of personal. Of course, I'm doing a podcast
right.
about it. But there's probably some more things that I don't talk about. But it was just a very special, just a special moment in time. And when Don Safran told me to sit back and watch this, that they don't make movies like this anymore, I realized afterwards what he was talking about. They didn't, with Ray involved, you didn't worry about budgets, you just spent money and, you know, stuff like that. It was just a wonderful moment, and I fortunately had the insight to watch it happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when you say you're educated, you are. I mean, I've read your resume, if you will, but let's talk about Clementine Hunter. You know, for the people who don't know who Clementine Hunter is, she's a very famous primitive artist from the location. And you're an expert on Clementine, aren't you?
I had a lot of association with Clementine. I went to undergraduate school here in Natchitoches at Northwestern, and I went out. I was working with an English teacher doing some television teaching on closed circuit, and she asked me one afternoon, would you like to go out to Clementine Hunter's? I was only a sophomore, and I went out with her. This was in 1965, and I was fascinated with this young lady, this elderly lady. She was then in her 80s that was painting pictures. And I just struck up a relationship, and I joined the faculty here in 1969. I was back 3 or 4 years later, and I started going to Clementine's once a day. And she was an amazing person. She could not read nor write, but she painted pictures that documented a lifestyle of plantation life that disappeared when mechanization came to agriculture. Nobody picked cotton anymore. Nobody, and her pictures told about all of that, religious scenes. And we became very good friends, and it's done a lot shaping my life. There's an exhibit up right now. I guess it's coming down sometime maybe next week at the Smithsonian African American in Washington of her work. And these are the memories that, you know, the still Clementine Hunter added another perspective to my life. This lady who could not read nor write, but yet has gained international acclaim for her creative work. And that tells you a lot about creativity, too. You don't have to be taught creativity. It can be in you. And you need to just explore it and embellish it.
Exactly. And I have seen, I guess, instances where there are so many people trying to duplicate her work and pass it off as her. It actually happened to me one time. I had an antique store many years ago, and this kid came in, and I knew who he was, but he claimed to be her nephew. And you're going to laugh, but he shows up with these two small, he said, you know, I've called her Clementine, so I can't change now, but he said, yeah, my aunt Clementine painted these and blah, 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 and I looked at him, I said, they're still wet. He said, yeah, she just finished them. I said, she died 2 weeks ago. Where have you been? I didn't buy them. But that's pretty common, I think.
Oh, I have many memories of Clementine, of course. But the best thing I ever did with Clementine was I worked with the FBI on a case that prosecuted. It's the first time they successfully prosecuted and sent two people to – they convicted three people for forging her work. And the FBI, it has set a precedent now in the federal FBI and the art community protecting the copyright and the creativity of folk artists. They had been sort of overlooked with fine arts and all of this. Everybody worries about fake Picassos or Rembrandts. Well, they were doing folk art fakes. And now with the prosecution of the Toys and Mr. Lucky, they successfully have shown the public and the art world as a whole that there's an integrity in the community of folk art. And they have protected it and, you know, really done a great job.
I wasn't aware of that, but that makes sense. But this kid, I just looked at him and I went, You really must think I'm stupid. Anybody else who hasn't been paying attention would have bought the darn thing, you know, with his thumbprint in it and all. They were still tacky. They were and I hadn't thought of that in years until, you know, I met you and I went, oh, yeah, you forget about things.
And there is an FBI agent, Randy Deaton, who in Alexandria, Louisiana, who still now, he's a member of the FBI, from this work on this case, has joined the International Art Forgery Team of the FBI. So he has his eyes on the whole world of markets for Clementine Hunter fakes, and he does, of course, other artwork, too. But it has been really an accomplishment, I think, to get someone at the federal level of prosecution to protect folk art copyrights.
Oh, absolutely. So tell us a little bit about her story for those of the audience who have no idea who we're talking about. Do you mind giving a bit of her history and how she came to prominence?
She was born in 1886 and down below Melrose, Louisiana, up in the country, way out in the woods. And she didn't start painting. We know she was painting in 1939. She came as a child to Melrose Plantation, and she worked initially in the fields helping pick cotton. But as she got older, she moved into the big house there. It's a large plantation, and worked as a domestic servant. She cooked and cleaned and things. And then in 1939, she saw people painting at Melrose and announced that she thought she could paint pictures like that. And she took some discarded tubes of paint left over from artists and went and started painting pictures. And people in the art world recognized that she had this ability to do something that nobody else could do, was paint scenes of plantation life from an insider's perspective. You know, she didn't have to, you know, artists look at paint scenes, but she was actually living it and painting it from her perspective.
And see, I look at some of these things, and you kind of have to stand there and say, what was the story here? I always want to know, what was she seeing? What was she saying? Because clearly, they're stories. No question about it.
Oh, yeah, they're storytelling. It's storytelling.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, listen, Tommy, thank you so much. It's been wonderful speaking with you, and I thank you for all the wonderful stories and reminisces. And is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience before we say goodbye?
I wish everyone a happy holiday season coming up.
Oh, thank you. Well, listen, before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us on iTunes and anywhere else you consume your podcasts, and just look for your partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Tommy, thank you so much. It has been a pleasure.
Good day.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.